I didn't have to become a minister. I had a good career in social work. I got to help people every day. I always had weekends off. I was very active in my Unitarian Universalist congregation, where I'd been a member, and I was a rising star in denominational leadership as a layperson. I really didn't need to do this. But on the other hand, I really did need to do this. You see, I got the call. Exactly who or what called me is open to your interpretation, but the call came in loud and clear. I always said I tried to let it go to voicemail for the longest time, but finally I had to answer. I just had to. I had to answer that call to serve our faith as a minister. Now, to put a foundation on that, I've always loved church. As I've said in other sermons, I was raised a Lutheran, but became a Unitarian Universalist when I was a young adult. The Lutheran church was fine for me, but I really needed a bigger box to hold my diverse beliefs. So I joined First Unitarian of Portland around 1980. I joined the choir immediately. And that group, the First Unitarian Church Choir, was the hub of my social life as an early adult. That's my husband and I were in the choir together. All our friends were in the choir. That's who we went out hanging out with on weekends. Within a few years, I became active in developing a program that was called Creative Age Concerns, which had a lot of similarity to our Eldertopia. That group became the foundation of my social work thesis. My husband and I directed the youth choir for a year. And after we had kids, I became active in children's religious education. I was on the RE committee, and I served as a teaching team leader. You see, we had to have teams because the RE program there was bigger than most public elementary schools in Portland. But there came a time I became very troubled. I would sit in church almost every Sunday and weep. No reason I could think of for weeping. I was fine. I was not unhappy at church, but I had this profound sense of spiritual need. I just couldn't stop crying. There was something inside of me that had to come out, and it had to do with my faith, and I just didn't know what to do with it. It was physically painful in its intensity. And I thought to myself, this had better not be a call to ministry because I really don't have time for that. But that's what do they say? We plan and God laughs. But I'd heard all these stories from women who said that they got a call, left their spouses, left their children, moved away to go to divinity school, and there was just no way I was going to do that to my family. Raising my children, I believe, is holy work. And I thought no genuine good call would take me from that task. But I did find another number of other folks who were in the ORE program with me at First Church, who had the similar interest in starting a new urban Unitarian Universalist congregation. First Church was growing like gangbusters. The second and third grade class that I taught, mind you, there were three sessions because there were three services. My session had 42 children registered. Many of us wanted something just a little smaller. Not tiny, but just a little smaller. And we didn't want to go to the suburbs because we were urban people. So I began making some phone calls and organizing some meetings. And within a year, I was the YEAST Unitarian Universalist Congregation, new congregation organizer, and founded that congregation that now meets in Northeast Portland. I found that the more I immersed myself in church work, the more it felt like I was being my best and most real self. And I stopped crying completely. I was blissed out. Blissed out as I cut my work week as a social worker down to 2 days a week of paid work so that I'd have enough time to do all my church building and church community work. This work got noticed by district leaders, and soon I found myself chair of the district's extension committee. That's the committee that's in charge of growing our faith. And soon I found myself on the Pacific Northwest District Board of Directors, eventually becoming its vice president. It was great. It was a great time. So So many folks began to ask me if I ever considered a career in ministry. And I always answered, oh, I'd love to, but I can't leave my family. But then I found out that I could actually become a Unitarian Universalist minister, meeting their requirements by getting a master's in applied theology at Merrillhurst, just down in West Lynn. It was a part-time program, so I could still work a little bit and still raise my kids, and I wouldn't have to move away. Well, I'll never forget. I decided I would just try one class. Just try one class, see what it felt like. So it was a class called Ministerial Identity or something like that. So at the beginning of the class, we all went around the room and introduced ourselves and why we were taking the class. And I said, oh, I thought I might have gotten a call to ministry, but I wasn't sure I was really going to do anything with it. And a wise old woman came up to me at the break and said, you know, how long are you going to keep kidding yourself? Once you get called, you don't get uncalled. And at that point, I knew that I was committed to the path of ordination. But I want to share with you guys what that path looked like and what it looks like for Unitarian Universalist ministers. Many people just don't know what kind of training and vetting we go through. In part, I think, because in decades past, they didn't do quite as much vetting and for the results, so now they're really quite careful. They're very choosy about who they let have be ministers. Yes, I do have a master's degree in theology, but that's certainly not all of it. When you begin your path to ministry, you fill out tons and tons of papers to go to the Unitarian Universalist Credentialing Office in Boston, and that puts you on their radar and in their system. You fill out forms, and you write essays, and you start school. And if all goes well, they make you an aspirant, which I know comes from the word aspire, but always sounds like aspirate to me. So you become an aspirant. And then you continue to go to school, and you meet with older, wiser ministers for training and evaluation. You have a full psychiatric evaluation, including an MMPI. They leave no stone unturned. If all that goes well over the course of time, then you get to be a candidate for the ministry. When you're a candidate, then you're allowed to join the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association as a student member. And then when you go to ceremonial functions, you're allowed to wear a robe. You are not allowed to wear a stole yet, but you're allowed to wear a robe. It's a big deal. Then you get your degree, plus you must read a raft of extra books that they require of you. You have to do an internship with an experienced UU minister in a congregation. I did mine in Corvallis, and it was a glorious year of learning from the Reverend Dr. Gretchen Woods. In addition to a parish ministry internship, we all have to do at least one unit of CPE, or clinical pastoral education. That's something where you take several months working in a hospital or a prison setting where you learn the skills of a chaplain. But you also learn how to discern your issues about death or abuse or aging or illness or whatever from the issues of others. And you learn how to deal with those issues for yourself so they do not get in the way in your ministry work. You learn to serve people where they are, regardless of your faith or theirs. You learn that you're not there to preach, but there to be present. I did my CPE at the Oregon State Hospital in Salem on the neuropsych ward, dealing with people with very severe brain illnesses like Huntington's and very bad head traumas, people who will never get well. Well, you'd think that would be enough. But no, there's also the MFC, the Ministerial Fellowship Committee of the UUA. They are the gatekeepers. Once you're a candidate, then you're allowed to make your appointment to see the MFC toward the end of your training. And for the MFC, you write lots of essays, gather tons and tons and tons of documentation and letters of recommendation showing your preparedness. They see the reports of your psych eval. They see the reports from your internship. They see all of your school records. They see everything. I traveled to Chicago for my MFC appointment along with several other candidates from all over the nation, because they happen a couple of times a year, and one in Boston, one in San Francisco, one in Chicago. I had practiced for months and months and months, practicing on my own with these little flashcards for the things I needed to remember, practicing in group with other ministerial candidates. So the day came, I went to Chicago, I wore a maroon suit and brown pumps and this chalice. I began by lighting the chalice in the room, and then I gave a really good 10-minute sermon. And then I was hammered with questions by this specially selected group of ministers and lay people. The questions could range anything from, in what year did they sign the Edict of Torta, to explain the Buddhist versus Hindu concepts of reincarnation, to, in your CPE report, it says here you struggled with issues of loss. How have you dealt with that? And then they give you all these, what if your congregation did this? Well, what if this happened in your congregation? What if somebody came to you with this? These kinds of scenarios. All during this time, you have to, you know, keep your calm, maintain some decorum. After a while, you're invited outside while they talk about you. And then you're invited back in, and they give you your decision. Are you ready to be a Unitarian Universalist minister? Yes, no, or not quite yet. If yes, you are granted preliminary fellowship. And at that point, you're approved for ordination. A congregation still has to choose to ordain you, because as you heard in my vows, only a congregation has the power to ordain. But you can then, at that point, ask a congregation, are you willing to do this? I was ordained by the Corvallis, the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Corvallis, because I was an intern at the time when I went to the MFC, and they were so proud of me. It was a very happy day. It's only after your ordination ceremony that you're allowed to wear a stole, because your first stole is given to you as part of your ceremony. And at that point, then you're allowed to be called the Reverend. In fact, if you look in the brochure that Abby read from, the first time when they say, are you ready, it says Ms. Sure. And then after it says, we hereby ordain you, it says Reverend Sure, which is the one who gives the response. That's the moment when it all happens. Now, even working as a new minister, the MFC keeps an eye on you. In preliminary fellowship, you must submit yearly reports and evaluations of your work, proving yourself. And after at least minimum of three years of successful ministry with good reports of all these people, then you are granted final fellowship. I was given final fellowship in 2013. But even final fellowship, if a minister commits some act of clergy misconduct, the MFC is the one the minister has to face for sanctions. And they can remove your ministerial fellowship if things are bad. It's happened to people I know. So on what kind of things are new ministers evaluated by the MFC? What are those areas we're expected to be competent in? Not only at the beginning of our ministry, but really the things we're expected to know and be able to do throughout our careers. What is it we do? Well, there are lots of areas that you might not even know are part of ministry. And that's part of what I'd like to share with you today, so you just get a sense of all the things that they expect us to be competent in and to know. Well, the first, of course, is pastoral care. That's what was so important to the people at WUF when you decided you wanted to have a minister come serve your congregation. Pastoral care includes counseling, visiting folks in the hospital, but also includes things like understanding family systems, understanding the nuances of confidentiality in a time of emergency. It means reaching out to people who might need you even when they have not asked for your help. It means being able to be compassionate when times get really tough. The second area of competency is referred to as the practical arts of ministry. This includes like the day-to-day tasks that happen behind the scenes that a lot of people don't know that we do that kind of work. It's stuff like staff and volunteer management, fundraising support, public relations, leadership development, working closely with the board, helping clarify roles around the congregation, working collaboratively with lay leadership. I have to say that this last few years at WUF, we have done so much work in that area of being clear with the lay leadership and the board and the staff about the roles and expectations of everybody. This is good work that we've been doing. Of course, we're going to be doing it for a lot longer because it's always a work in progress, but we have really done some great work in that area the last few years. The third area of competency is called organizational ministry. That includes supporting growth, helping integrate and welcome new members, nurturing lay leaders in their important work, involvement in long-range and short-range planning, conducting programs to help strengthen the health of the community, reaching out to different age groups. It's basically tending to the health of the organization and helping it to thrive. The fourth, personal and professional growth. You see, we're supposed to actually maintain healthy work-life balance and tend to our own spiritual health. Because we're supposed to be good role models. We're supposed to convey positive and energy and enthusiasm. We're supposed to stay spiritually and emotionally grounded, in part so that we are strong enough to give folks negative feedback as well as positive feedback when needed, and to be able to receive constructive criticism ourselves in a graceful manner. We're expected to be calm and pastoral in the face of congregational conflicts because you know they happen. Sometimes. The fifth is teaching. I'm reminded that the title rabbi is synonymous with the title teacher. That means teaching folks of all ages and all stages. In fact, right now, I am teaching. I'm teaching you guys some things about ministry. But it also includes planning and conducting classes and workshops, supporting teachers in all age groups, developing seminars for religious professionals, creating and supporting intergenerational activities, articulating good religious education philosophy, and supporting the parents in a congregation as they raise good UU kids. Sixth area of ministry is worship. It's often the most public thing that we do. The first thing that most people think of when they see a minister, and they think that's what we spend most of our time on. We're expected to be inspirational, creative, intellectually challenging, spiritually grounded, as well as making appropriate use of humor. I'm quoting that out of the book. We're expected to be good storytellers and to be able to lead people in public prayer and meditation. We're also expected to be able to serve people through the rites of passage, weddings, memorials, child dedications, coming-of-age ceremonies. I have to say, I love that part of ministry, the rites of passage. It is such an honor to officiate and hold the space for people at important life events, really big transitions in their lives. It is the greatest honor. We're also expected to take part in denominational activities as part of our ministry. That means attending UUA events, gatherings to stay informed ourselves, so that we can help our congregation continue to be informed on what's going on in our larger faith. We encourage denominational involvement amongst the people in the congregation. And this also includes interfaith outreach and collaboration with other ministers. Given that I came up through the ranks of denominational leadership as a layperson, I'm a huge fan of doing denominational work. You might have noticed that. I talk about it all the time. I'm still very active doing that work as a member of the Pacific Western Region Transitions Team. That means I'm one of the people who comes out and helps a congregation when they're getting a new minister or saying goodbye to an old one. And last but not least, we're expected to take part in what's called prophetic outreach. That's a fancy way of saying social justice work. It means preaching social justice-oriented sermons. It means encouraging our congregations to get out there and be involved in building a better world. It could be anything from protest marches to feeding the children programs. I am so proud of the work we do at WOF, being a green sanctuary, being a GBLTQ welcoming congregation. And as ministers, we're not supposed to just be armchair quarterbacks. As ministers, we're expected to take part in justice work ourselves. It's part of how we live our faith and our values as Unitarian Universalists. Now, you might have noticed that there is a lot of stuff we're expected to know and do as ministers. A whole lot of it. And there are a couple of realities that go along with this list that I need to share. One is that no minister, whoever they are, nobody, is truly great at all aspects of the job. Some of us really shine as preachers. Some of us do our very best work when we're sitting with those who grieve. Some people are just really gifted at church management. We all need to be competent in all the areas, but no one is perfect at everything all the time. We have human limitations. And also, you know, some days we do better than others. Just kind of how it goes. The best ministers know their strengths and use them to help the congregations they serve. And they work on the weak points, but also know sometimes that you just need to delegate some tasks. For instance, one of the things that is true is that I kind of glaze over when faced with too many budget numbers. I know I have to understand the basic budget at WOOF. I know I have to understand it. But mostly I really let the money experts deal with the gory details of predicting expenditures and creating budgets. The other reality is that most of us don't have time to do it all. That's why really big congregations like First Unitarian in Portland or University Church in Seattle have two or three ministers. But I want to tell you something honest about serving a congregation the size of West Hills at halftime. I really, really don't have time to do it all. That's why, as much as I love taking part in justice work, I really don't ever do more than cheer and wave at our social justice committee at WOOF. I just don't have the time to spend there. I'm the staff responsible for supporting our adult religious education programs, but I can barely make the time to do the few adult RE offerings I help with every year. People have asked me to do others, and I just have to say no. And I don't even count the denominational activities I do in my WOOF hours. Even though I really should, because they're part of good ministry, but I just don't. This month's theme here at WOOF is service, service to the wider world. I serve the wider world by serving as a Unitarian Universalist minister who is serving one of our congregations. Because service is what ministers do. We serve as organizational consultants. We serve as spiritual advisors. We serve as listeners. And sometimes we serve as cheerleaders. We serve the very best we can, given our human strengths and imperfections. But I need to tell you that it is truly an honor to serve as your minister. Thank you.